It's summer in Spokane, which means high temperatures. And one good way to beat those temperatures is to indulge in a marathon of movie going. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And truth be told, marathon movie going is a way of life for Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and me. On this week's show, the three of us will discuss a trio of films that we saw in the refrigerated comfort of local theaters. Edgar Wright's celebration of speed and sound, Baby Driver, Sofia Coppola's version of Thomas Cullinan's 1966 novel, The Beguiled, and Benny Boom's biopic of Tupac Shakur, All Eyes on Me. So don't touch that dial, because Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Free your radio and hear Spokane Public Radio wherever you go when you listen live on your mobile phone, tablet, or computer at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Just click on Listen Live, pick your station, and start listening. Tune in anytime for NPR programs, local news, music, public affairs, arts news, and more at KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ. You can listen to all three live from our website by clicking the blue Listen Live link at the top. Whichever station you choose, SPR travels with you, keeps you company, and keeps you in touch with the world. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen live.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that thrives in air-conditioned atmospheres, both here in our Spokane Public Radio studio, but especially in those offered by local movie houses. We've been missing our resident diva, Mary Pat, for much of the last couple of months, and we're glad to have her back, especially since one of the movies we'll be discussing during this week's show, All Eyes on Me, involves one of her favorite rap performers, Tupac Shakur. We'll also talk about the newest releases from a pair of would-be auteur directors, Edgar Wright's Baby Driver and Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled. Let's begin with A Need for Speed. I've long marveled how often those who make movie trailers get it wrong, but I can't think of a trailer in recent memory that so misrepresents a movie as did the original trailer for Edgar Wright's Baby Driver. You may know Wright from the three films that he made with comic actor Simon Pegg, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. His new film, which he wrote and directed, seems like a standard heist flick with our young hero, the baby of the film's title, played by Ansel Elgort, being a talented getaway driver for a revolving team of armed robbers hired by the mob boss Doc, played by Kevin Spacey. But the similarities end there, because Baby Driver is less about plot than it is about style, which Wright has shown in all his movies. This time, though, that sense of style is even more apparent. Yes, Baby has a past which haunts him. Yes, he has a preternatural talent for driving cars, even those owned by little old ladies, faster and more skillfully than Steve McQueen. Yes, he finds a romantic interest, which is the weak link that forces him reluctantly to do one last job with a crew of psychos, well played by Jamie Foxx and John Hamm. But here's the twist. For most of its running time, Baby Driver is more symphony than cinema. It moves from one movement to the next as smoothly as a Chopin nocturne rebooted by Dr. Dre. I've seen many movies that have been built around music, but this is one of the first times I've seen music used as the basis for a film. In the end, despite its plotline, there is little that is ordinary about Baby Driver. It truly is something different.
Yeah, before we discuss the music, which I think is probably the most important component of Baby Driver, I sort of want to talk about Edgar Wright in general, because this is a guy who, in pretty much all of his films, has taken different genres and kind of matched them up in ways that you don't expect. You think of Shaun of the Dead,
which is a
romantic comedy and a slacker comedy, but also a zombie film.
And it begins pretty much the same way this film does, with one long single take that takes you in a direction you don't think you're going to go
in. Or Hot Fuzz, which is this kind of rural cop mystery film and an investigative film, and then turns into, you know, a Michael Bay action movie in the second half. And Baby Driver is no different. I mean, it's this car chase movie that owes a lot to movies like the Steve McQueen films that you mentioned, or Walter Hill's The Driver with Ryan O'Neal, which Wright has talked at length about the influences that he's taken from that film and kind of puts it with almost a musical. I mean, the two opening sequences of Baby Driver, which I think are the two best sequences in the entire movie. And I think if there is a problem with Baby Driver, it's that it's really front-loaded, because the opening sequence is this amazing chase sequence that's set to a John Spencer Blues Explosion song. And it's so fun and acrobatic right out of the gate. And then Wright follows that up with this long take musical number that reminded me a lot of the traffic jam sequence at the beginning of La La Land.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't know if it was actually one long shot or if he superimposed multiple shots, but it's set to Harlem Shuffle, the old 60s R&B song. And you see portions of the song physically manifest themselves in the environment the baby is in. And I thought that was terrific. And the rest of the movie just doesn't keep that energy going. There are some good individual sequences throughout. There's a shootout. They all involve music pretty much. I mean, there's a sequence in which there's a gunfight that's set to this cover of Tequila, where the bullets actually syncopate along with the music. And then there's a chase sequence on foot, this time through a shopping center, in which every store Baby ducks into has sort of a different song playing, but they're kind of all of a piece. And I thought both of those were really great. The plot itself, as you mentioned, is pretty straightforward. I mean, he falls in love with a waitress played by Lily James, who we last saw, I think, in Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella remake. She's been in
and,
other
and
stuff.
And anybody who's in Downton Abbey knows her, right?
Oh, is she in that? I never watched it. But the point is, they have a nice kind of chaste relationship. They have a good chemistry, but the characters themselves aren't all that deep. I mean, Wright gives Baby this tragic backstory, but I don't think that it really adds anything to the movie in the end.
Plus, it doesn't quite make sense and come
together.
Not really.
And it's funny because, you know, he's leaning on these McQueen films and these Walter Hill films, in which the lead characters kind of had this glowering sense of self-importance, and yet we never found out anything about them. In fact, the driver in that film didn't even have a name. It's kind of more in keeping with Nicholas Winding Refn's Drive. But I liked this overall because we don't see action movies that are this original, at least in terms of the way that the action is implemented and smart, even though I think, like all of his movies, I think this one does kind of lose momentum as it goes on. What's weird about it, though, is it loses momentum as it becomes more frenzied. I don't know what's going on with that.
Well, I think part of the problem with Baby Driver, if there is a problem, because I enjoyed it a lot as well, is the fact that, you know, it doesn't really have a plot line or a story that's all that compelling ultimately. It has these characters, and then we'll talk about the music, which is the primary focal point here. I do think that this film benefited from some excellent performances. I had a few problems, strangely enough, with Kevin Spacey, and maybe it's just because I binge-watched House of Cards, and Frank Underwood is a much scarier character than Doc ever will or could be. I also was not a huge fan of the casting of Isa Gonzalez. She just didn't work for me. She won me over ultimately. And then we have Jamie Foxx and John Hamm playing against type, although I'll say Don Draper from Mad Men was much scarier to me than this particular character.
The character that John Hamm plays kind of feels like what would have happened to Don Draper had his career continued to go down the tubes.
Right. Or if he was born a few years later.
Because you do find out the backstory of John Hamm's character, and he comes from, what, Wall Street, right? And now he's this, neck tattooed.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, Nathan, part of the problem is they try to have it all different ways here, ultimately, because I think when you have these anonymous driver people, then you don't need to tell their backstory. Here, they try to tell the backstory, get us enthralled or connected to him in some way, but then they don't quite make it work somehow. I mean, there's another person that we have not talked about who actually in this particular film I liked a lot, and it is C.J. Jones. Jones plays Joe, who is Baby's foster father, and so they sign back and forth, and I thought that was an interesting twist
deaf,
here.
Right.
Yes, and also we know that Baby has tinnitus as a result of his earlier accident. So I think the performances overall were good. The problem is the storyline ultimately is weak and problematic, I think. Does that matter? No, you're going to have a good time, I believe. And it's interesting because at the beginning of the film, the one thing we haven't talked about, the director, Edgar Wright, shows up and you're like, why is he here? Does he want money for something? No, he's here to tell us, I'm really happy that you came to see this movie on the big screen in a theater, because that's how it was meant to be seen. And I agree with that totally. Sometimes I think you can sit at home in your, home theater room or whatever, and kick back and watch films.
Or in your little garret apartment on your laptop, which is how Nathan sees a lot of movies.
You don't know how I watch movies.
Yeah, really. Okay. But I think this one does need to be seen in
also,
the theater
I don't live
for sure.
In a garret. What are you talking about?
I think both of you have made some good points and some other ones. No, Seriously, I think, Nathan, you hit right on the key. The problem, if there is a problem with Baby Driver, is that there's so much that's front-loaded that the final one-third of the film, it just can't hold up. That's when he starts getting into the storyline, and we don't need to. We've seen this story a jillion times. What we want is what he's given us in the opening sequence and all through, which is this symphony that's playing out as a movie, and we want him to continue that and find a way to improve on it, and he doesn't actually. So the final third of the film left me down a little bit. But that's not to say that I didn't really enjoy Baby Driver. Edgar Wright is somebody to watch. I called him and Sofia Coppola would-be auteurs. They're people whose style you can recognize. And I look forward to seeing the next film by him.
Right. And, we talk about the use of music and how important it is and how the best sequences in this film are music-centric. Even in the last third of the movie, there's this showdown in a parking garage between all the different players. I don't want to give anything away, but right. It's set to, and it's a song that keeps getting referenced a lot, the Queen song Brighton Rock, which is established early on. That's the song that gets Baby really fired up. That's his go-to track. And Wright sets this scene to that song, but he doesn't use the song in inventive ways in the way that he used music in previous sequences. And so I think that kind of loses, especially after they've given all this momentum to it, like eventually you're going to hear this really awesome Queen song. And then he doesn't really use it in a way that I thought was
well.
All that
the
fresh.
Other thing is, I think people need to be aware, and maybe it's just because I just finished spending a little time in Mexico, but Tequila, that song became an earworm, and so I think people need to be on notice that you could be humming or singing that song, and it's not my favorite one, but It does get your energy up if you. Want to go?
You should also be on notice that Paul Williams has a cameo in this movie.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think there should be more Paul Williams cameos
absolutely.
In future
absolutely.
Films. But yeah, the further away I get from Baby Driver, the less enthusiastic I am about it, because leaving the theater right away, I was like, that was really great. I don't think it's great, but I think that we see so few movies that are this energetic that, you
and
have
I
to give credit where it's due.
And I had the same response, because when you come out, you really are all fired up, and I was expecting Dan to,
speed
race
all the way
down
home.
The highway. Yeah, but he didn't. So I say you'll have fun. It's a great summer movie.
Yep. Yeah.
That was Baby Driver, and this is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. But before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Beguiled and All Eyes on Me. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Edgar Wright's Baby Driver. Let's now move to a couple of other releases, Sofia Coppola's interpretation of the novel The Beguiled, and Benny Boom's look at the life of the late Tupac Shakur. All Eyes on Me. Let's begin with a trek into some sultry Southern Gothic steam. In 1966, writer Thomas Cullinan saw publication of his first novel, The Beguiled. 5 years later, that novel was adapted for the big screen by director Don Siegel, starring Clint Eastwood and Geraldine Page. Now, these four decades plus later, Sofia Coppola offers up her version of the story. Basically, that story, which is set in Virginia in the year 1864 during the height of the Civil War, involves a wounded soldier for the Union Army who was taken in, tended to, and offered a reprieve, at least temporarily, by the headmistress and students of a southern boarding school for girls. The soldier, played this time by the Irish actor Colin Farrell in full brogue, is at first grateful, though from the beginning he tries to endear himself to any of the women or girls, there are seven of them in all, who will pay him any attention. But who ends up beguiling whom is the question that writer-director Coppola, working from the base material, explores, and I'm not sure she ever comes up with a satisfactory answer. Coppola has style, to be sure. The boarding school, captured in perpetual soft focus, is a blend of safe haven and something out of a Bram Stoker story, especially at night, with the school's dark corners cast in shadow by candlelight. And few movie sequences I've ever seen are more lustful than the scene where the headmistress, played by Nicole Kidman, washes the soldier's nearly nude body, pausing slightly, breathing heavily, as she strokes ever so close to the unconscious man's loincloth. But some rather heavy-handed transitions involving both temperament and plot twist prove confusing and in the end leave Coppola's intent, well, pardon the pun, lost in translation.
I agree with what was her intent in making this film question that you've posed, because I don't know the answer to that. And here's the problem. I did not see the original Beguiled, and so I'll be interested to hear some input into that, because my understanding was it had a very different tone and perspective than does hers. And I was going back and forth throughout this film trying to figure out if she was just making a period piece, if she was making sort of a female revenge film, if she was giving an opportunity to showcase the talents of the various A-list actors who she has, Kirsten Dunst, Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell, and then the girls as well. So we have Elle Fanning and some newcomers. I didn't know what she was trying to accomplish. As all of her films do, it has a really nice sense of place, and the art direction is amazing. You could feel the heat, the sort of languid spirit of what was happening during this time period in this place. But why this film? I don't know the answer.
That was kind of the question I had walking out of The Beguiled as well, was what exactly was Coppola trying to say with this film? Granted, I mean, we see movies all the time that really aren't trying to say anything at all, but she's the kind of director that doesn't take things just because she can. So I'm still working on that one. I think you should see the Don Siegel version of this novel, because I think these two versions actually kind of work as companion pieces, because I think they both do things well that the other versions don't do. So the Siegel version, I mean—
And that's the 1971
film, from 1971, right? With Clint Eastwood, has this almost hysterical intensity. I mean, it's a crazy movie. And it makes all of the characters' motivations mostly pretty clear. I mean, we understand exactly where the Eastwood character is coming from, exactly where the Geraldine Page character is coming from. We see their backstories. Siegel uses a flashback structure so that we can kind of see that the things that they're saying don't match the things that they've done in the past. And so that makes the lies they tell each other more obvious, whereas Coppola doesn't give us any of that.
Nope,
and
nothing.
So I think it's an interesting approach, but this material is so pulpy in a way. I mean, this book is sort of a potboiler, right? And by playing it so stately, by playing your cards so close to your chest, I mean, it kind of makes it even more ridiculous, if that makes sense, because she's brought this air of pomposity and artfulness to it. Siegel had no, what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, I mean, it almost ends up being a comedy.
He didn't have any pretensions about himself. You know?
Some sort of
but
commentary.
But he was a terrific director.
Sure.
Siegel was a terrific
And I think Coppola is a terrific director, too. And I think that—
In a completely different way, completely different era. Yes.
Stylistically, I really liked this. I thought the performances were good.
Philippe Lesueur, the cinematographer. French cinematographer, is superb.
Absolutely.
He was nominated for an Oscar for the Wong Kar-wai movie, The Grandmaster.
And the natural light they use here is really great. But yeah, I'm not totally sure how this story matters now as opposed to how it mattered in 1971. There's been a lot of talk about the
excluding pieces from the original story.
You know, notion of slavery in this setting. I mean, I think it's almost hilariously tone deaf what Sofia Coppola has done with race in a lot of her movies. But I think overall, I liked this movie, even though I'm not sure if there's any there.
The interesting thing about The Beguiled, other than the fact that it's a step up Colin Farrell from Clint Eastwood, because Clint Eastwood, whatever his talents are, as an actor.
What are you talking about?
Whatever his talents is an actor.
Colin Farrell, you heard that. Colin Farrell is a step up from Clint Eastwood.
He is.
Dan just said that on the record.
In this movie, this was the same era of Dirty Harry. Mm-hmm. That was Clint Eastwood then, not in something like this.
The role that Clint Eastwood plays in the Siegel version makes perfect sense to cast Clint Eastwood in that. Colin Farrell wouldn't work in that version.
No, you're right.
So I think that the casting is just right.
What about the Nicole Kidman character versus Geraldine Page?
Well, Geraldine Page, I mean, she plays this role. She's kind of a kook. She takes more relish in the role. And so this idea of it being sort of a revenge story comes through clear in Siegel's version, whereas here, we're never quite sure if the Kidman character is doing what she's doing because she's getting some kind of erotic charge out of it, or because it's just self-preservation.
Right. And, you know, I mean, we can say about The Beguiled, it's worth seeing simply for how it's made, but
yes.
I don't know that there's any real there. And that was Sofia Coppola's The Beguiled. Let's close with another look at the late Tupac Shakur, All Eyes on Me. By now, the story of Tupac Shakur is familiar to most of us. In every medium, from supermarket tabloid to cable news to big screen documentary, I recommend the 2003 production Tupac Resurrection, the late rapper's story has been told. Born the son of Black Panther Party activists, transplanted from New York to Baltimore to California, joining the rap group Digital Underground, releasing his own material, snaring some choice movie roles, finding fame and controversy, getting shot and spending time in jail for sexual assault, joining forces with Death Row Records, finding more fame and even more controversy as the center of the West Coast versus East Coast hip-hop feud before him being shot to death in Las Vegas at the tender age of 25. Director Benny Boom, known mostly for making music videos for the likes of Nicki Minaj and others, follows the standard storyline, filling in the details with material provided by a trio of screenwriters. Boom's Tupac is a complicated character, likely as he was in real life, at times a voice for social justice, at other times purely a kid in his 20s with too much money and testosterone to make good decisions. Demetrius Shipp Jr. does a decent job of portraying Tupac, although no one could compare with the real thing. And the movie does have moments, one of my favorites being Jared Ellis as Snoop Dogg boarding a plane with Tupac and Suge Knight and lifting a flight attendant's knife for his own protection. Still, to get a better overall view, I'd stick with a good documentary, maybe even the authorized one that 12 Years a Slave director Steve McQueen has just contracted to make.
All Eyes on Me tells the story of Tupac Shakur. Great, but I think many people know the story, and it doesn't add anything to what we already know or are aware of. So then you have to rely on how the film is put together. And that's my main problem. It's just kind of boring. And it's a straightforward sort of linear portrayal for the most part. There are some good performances, as Dan alluded to. And I particularly liked the actress who played Tupac's mom. I thought that Demetrius Shipp acquitted himself nicely in this whole thing. There's been all this litigation about this film from various quarters. And I think that Tupac Shakur estate needs to figure out what it wants to do with his legacy, because we've already seen all these posthumous releases of his music. We've seen him as a hologram. There was a Broadway musical that didn't quite make it. So I don't know. I mean, I'm just curious why this had to happen at all. I agree with Dan. See a documentary, see the original Tupac, go back and see some of the movies that he was in. And no, I don't know who killed him.
Yeah. Yeah. This is no good. I mean, it feels like a Wikipedia entry that they made into a film. At times, it feels like a parody of a biopic that we would have seen in like Tropic Thunder or something. I mean, it's got some some howlingly bad dialogue that serves only for exposition, you know, to tell us things. And yeah, if you know Tupac, this isn't going to tell you anything new. If you don't know Tupac, you're going to come away from this movie going, why does this guy matter? And so in my estimation, that means it's a failure as a biopic. But you're right. The acting is good. It was good to hear California Love. And that's all I have to say about that.
And that was All Eyes on Me. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Baby Driver and The Beguiled. Let's not forget to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show. And we certainly thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again share a bit of California. Check that. I mean, movie love. Until then, consider these words from the late Tupac Shakur. I didn't create thug life, I diagnosed it. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.